he was a real character. You wanted him. If he were on the road, he wanted Earl Strong to be one of the referees. He didn't care about the crowd. He loved to stick it to the crowd. Actually, something happened. I was ticked off, and the ball was on the court. I see Earl going over to pick the ball up, and just before he picks it up, I kick it, and he would have been proud as a soccer guy. That ball went like this, just went way up in the stand, tech me, threw me out, and so it was an exhibition game. It was like the best kick I ever did for a basketball.
Oh, my goodness. And how did Earl react?
He just, you know, I mean, so I went, got me a beer, a hot dog, and sat up in the top of the stands and watched the ball game.
Then you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off, and there's number 23, and of course, Johnny goes nuts.
We're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass, yes. Christian, can you catch the ball, yes.
All the stars were aligned, and all the muscles fired at the right time, and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 125. Thanks for joining me. Today, I'm excited to welcome Basketball Hall of Fame legend Dave Cowens, the first NBA Most Valuable Player to appear on the podcast. Huge thanks to great friend of the show, Bob Ryan, for connecting me with Dave. In this fun, insightful, and wide-ranging conversation, Dave discusses his days at Newport Catholic High School and run-ins with the assistant principal, who also doubled as his basketball coach. Dave details his recruitment to Florida State University, where he was a four-year standout with the Seminoles. He recounts an intriguing letter he wrote to Celtic legend and then Cincinnati Royals coach Bob Cousy, ahead of the 1970 NBA draft. Dave was a busy man in the lead-up to his rookie debut with the Celtics. During the week, he played in Boston's Neighborhood Basketball League and on weekends commuted to New York City to play in the famed Rucker League. For good measure, Dave teamed with Pistol Pete Maravich and stole the show at the Maurice Stokes Memorial Basketball Game. Of course, there's plenty of NBA and Celtics discussion. We chat about the two titles Dave won with Boston in the 1970s, how he prepared for games and battled with all-time great centers that often had a significant height advantage over him. We even found time to talk about Larry Legend too. This conversation primarily covers Dave's on-court days. Hopefully he'll return to the show and discuss his post-playing career and life after basketball. This truly is a candidate for my favorite episode yet. If you enjoy this chat and you're on Twitter, I'd be most grateful if you consider a quick tweet to Bob Ryan, at Globe Bob Ryan, thanking him for the connect with Mr. Cowens. This conversation certainly would not have happened without Bob's continued generosity. Towards the end of the episode, I'll share another great podcast review. If you can spare a moment, please add your review via Apple Podcasts. It'd be most appreciated. Show notes for this episode and access to a huge archive of past episodes are available at inallairness.com. Now, onto the show. My guest today occupies rarefied air. He was NBA Rookie of the Year in 1971, All-Star Game and League MVP in 1973, and is a two-time NBA champion. He's an eight-time All-Star, a three-time All-NBA selection and a Hall of Fame legend, Dave Cowens. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you on the show today. Big thanks to a close friend of yours, Bob Ryan, for helping us connect. You participated in many sports as a youngster, and in high school you were doing things like running, other field events, high jump, and football, just to name a few. Before we actually get into your basketball journey, what other sports took your fancy as a young boy, Dave?
Well, I was lucky to have a lot of friends that loved sports. They were all a little bit older than I was. We did everything. We played football when it was football season, and baseball, basketball, and did a lot of swimming and diving and gymnastics and whenever it was. I loved track and field. That was a lot of fun because you were kind of on your own. There wasn't really no coaches around. You just kind of worked on doing whatever you were doing with the guys that were performing in the same events. But just kind of a typical kid that had a lot of energy and wanted to move around a lot.
You're part of a rather large family. I think there were six of you in the family. Is that correct?
Yeah, five boys and a girl.
Where did you fall within the range of the hierarchy there of the kids?
I was the second oldest.
From what I've read as well, you made the freshman basketball team but stopped playing after about a month or so and didn't rejoin your high school team, which was Newport Catholic, until your junior season, when I believe that your would-be coach, Jim Connor, noticed the significant growth spurt that you had after your sophomore season. How quickly did basketball become your primary focus, and what was it like to jump up in height in between that sophomore and junior season and start playing basketball?
I've read a lot of biographies of players and athletes, and it seems like they all had a growth spurt sometime in high school. I was the same way. Because I was very active, I maintained a lot of my coordination as I got taller, fortunate to do that. Basketball was just another game to play. It was just all about the love of competition and having a good time, meeting new people, the challenges of playing against people. Nobody really knows what they're doing when they're a young person and playing, just out there trying to figure it out. Hopefully you get chosen in to play the games, and when you're in there, you do the best you can. So I really didn't think about basketball as a primary sport until I got a scholarship for basketball at Florida State. That's kind of when I stopped participating in other sports. First of all, I went to college, so really, you weren't going to play any sports in college. You were busy going to school and doing your thing. And that's when I really started focusing on becoming a better basketball player and a better specimen, be stronger, gaining weight and doing the things you need to do to be able to compete against the upgraded competition that you're playing against. When I was in high school, I was probably 6'6", 190 when I graduated. I was about the same size, a little bigger than most everybody I played against. But when I got to college, I mean, there was a guy 6'10", 6'9", you know, 6'8". And a little bit bigger and older. So you say, well, if we're going to step up my game, what can I do? Then you figure, well, I better get a little bit stronger. That's what I worked on that as well.
You're a blue-collar player for sure, fan favorite, an all-time great of the league and the Celtics, of course. Where do you think that intensity and that blue-collar nature came from?
I think people are self-motivated more than they are motivated from an external source. And that was true for me. I just never wanted to be embarrassed while I was playing. I think as a kid, you never want to be embarrassed. That's the worst thing that happened to you. Sports was a place where you knew the rules. For the most part, it's going to be fair. And everybody's playing at the same level for the most part. So I gravitated towards that sport. And then when I was out there, it's like, I just want to have as much fun as I possibly can. And I got to the point where what I wanted, my goal was, I never wanted the coach to have a reason to take me out of the game. I was not a very good bench player. If I wasn't playing, I wasn't happy. I wanted to play all the time.
I can understand that. Your coach at the time in high school, Jim Connor, he was also the assistant principal of your school. Did you ever have any clashes either on or off the court because of that?
All the time.
In what way?
I was kind of his whipping boy, you know, as the new guy. And I remember after one game I played, I thought I played a pretty good game. And the next day in practice, he came in, they brought the team together, and he waxed me up one side of the head and out the other. He goes, everything you say to Callum goes in one ear and out the other. We had that kind of a relationship. But he was a military guy. That was his background. And he was an assistant principal, also the head baseball coach, that basketball coach, athletic director, you know, at a Catholic high school, all boys, there was 850 of us. You had to have some kind of authoritarian presence. He was that for us.
He's a busy man too, by the sound of things.
Busy man.
As a high school senior, you averaged 13 points and 20 rebounds per game and helped lead your Thoroughbreds to a 29-3 record. You're the 9th region champion before bowing out in the 1966 Kentucky State High School Tournament. From what I've read, that final game was at Freedom Hall in Louisville and played in front of almost 15,000 fans, which is quite amazing to hear. What sort of springs to mind when you get reminded of that senior season at Newport Catholic, Dave?
Well, we're disappointed because we thought we had a chance to win the tournament. Our school had never won a state tournament in basketball up to that point. We just ran into a team, Glasgow, I believe it was. They were just incredibly good. I think the guy was guarding. I don't think he missed a shot. He was like 9 for 9, made all his free throws. The next game they played, they went back to earth and they got killed. But against us, they played extremely well. And also, our best player, Terry Sandfox, who averaged 20 points a game, and he was our point guard. He had a fever, like a 102 fever, and he was sick. But he played, but he was not even close to being what he normally would be. And I remember one time he was like almost dribbling the wrong way on the floor. Just one of those things that happened. But that was at the same time that University of Kentucky was playing Texas El Paso, when they had the first all-black team playing an all-white team. It's been documented. I forget the name of it, but it's been made into a movie. I remember driving back on the bus and listening to their game on the radio. In Kentucky, of course, you're interested because it's University of Kentucky.
Please forgive my ignorance, but were you recruited at all by Kentucky?
No, I was not. I had about 10 offers from different Division I schools. Mostly right in the area that I lived, Xavier, University of Cincinnati, Moorhead, Murray, Eastern Kentucky, Western Kentucky, and Louisville, Memphis, and Christian Brothers. A lot of Division II schools, Ball State and ones like that. And then Florida State. Remember the first time I was out of play, flew down to Florida State and visited the campus. The coach, Hugh Durham, was a Kentucky native. He recruited me pretty hard. So I decided to go out of state and go to Florida State. They had ever really a basketball program to speak of. As a matter of fact, they had always been a co-ed institution. I think it was in the late 40s, right after World War II. With the GI Bill, they had to have a place for all these guys to come back and go to school so that they made Florida State a co-ed. Before that, it was a school for women. So when I went there, I think they were only, 15, 16 years from being an all-women's school. They were building a program. And that's one of the things I liked about it, because there wasn't any pressure to play after Kentucky grades or West Unseld at Louisville or any of these other places. It was just go down there, go have a good time. It was like 6 girls for every guy on campus. It was an awesome experience.
It certainly sounds like it. That's a pretty good ratio, that one.
Kind of like where you live, right? It's awesome over there.
It is a beautiful country here in Australia. One of the reasons I mentioned Kentucky was that I came across some interesting parallels between you and a Kentucky great, Dan Issel.
Yeah.
Particularly your date of birth are exactly the same date.
Exactly.
And he obviously was a great player with Kentucky, and he was a 6-time All-Star in the ABA before leagues merged, and he joined the NBA.
Dan Issel, he was from Illinois, and he was their guy that they wanted. He was a great, great high school player, scored a lot of points, unlike me, 13 points a game. Not anything you're going to write home about. You could say born on the same day. I looked at his career. He played throughout his entire career almost every year. He played it every game almost. I think he only missed like maybe 10 games out of hundreds and hundreds that he played. He was an Iron Man for sure.
Exactly the term I was thinking of, Iron Man as well. Now, in late May of 1966, you signed a grant in aid scholarship with Florida State. As you mentioned, there was numerous colleges that were trying to recruit you. Hugh Durham was the soon-to-be head coach. I think he was an assistant at the time when he was recruiting you.
He was.
How did you find that transition to your first season playing at Florida State? I believe at that time, freshmen weren't able to play on the varsity team, but you were part of the baby Seminoles, they were called.
We had a freshman team. I think we played 18 games. We played some junior colleges and the freshman team of other schools that our varsity teams played. Once I got down there, I didn't like it at all. I wanted to go home. It was like around September, October, because we went early. We were on a trimester system, so we were down there in August. And it was really hot in Tallahassee. I'm in Kentucky, but it's really hot in Tallahassee, Florida. They were in the dormitory. And I liked all the guys, but I really was homesick. I had a girlfriend that I left back at Newport that was riding back and forth. And, oh, I miss you. I miss you. I miss you. And I said, I'm out of here. So and I was ready to go back home and just get a regular job and do whatever. But then things worked out. I made a decision in my mind that I need to be going to college, and I got a great opportunity to play basketball. So I stayed there and went on from there. I enjoyed it after that, once I get finished with the whole separation issue.
It must be tough to move completely to another part of the country and then try and set yourself up there in college.
It is, but I think about a lot of guys, they get drafted and went to Vietnam. They had a hell of a lot worse than I did. And that wasn't voluntary. That was when they forced to do that because they had a draft. So considering what I was going through, it was nothing compared to what those guys had to deal with.
They were obviously conscripted. So, yeah, fair point and a good context for sure. You studied criminology at Florida State. What got you into that area of interest?
I enjoyed social sciences and studying behavior. A kid that took up criminology so I knew how to stay out of trouble and get out of trouble. I was able to do my coursework and still do basketball and all the other things that was going on. I took a lot of different humanities courses, things like that, but it was a course load that I could handle. I was an okay student. I was not a great student, but I was an okay student. And if I applied myself, I could get passing grades.
Looking through some newspaper reports, I came across a game that took place on December the 16th of 1967. You had 24 points and pulled down a career-high 31 rebounds for FSU in a game against Louisiana State. And their star, the great Pistol Pete Maravich. Now, he had 42 points in this game, but your Seminoles had the win. It was 130-100. It was a consolation game in Milwaukee Classic, I believe it was called. Does that actual game reside somewhere within your memory bank, Dave?
Oh, sure. Obviously, a lot of missed shots. And Pete had no conscience. I always thought, all my teammates, anybody played against, I'm not mad at you if you shoot and miss, because that's in my bailiwick. Now I'm going to get a rebound. I'm happy you're missing, actually. He did 42, but he probably took 40 shots. I was a sophomore that year. And one guy I know had 20 rebounds. The other one had in the high teens. So a lot of missed shots. And you figure in a 40-minute game with no three-pointers, there's 230-point score.
Biggest score from your Seminoles team in school history to that point. Your paths would cross again going forwards with Pistol Pete, and we'll get to that a bit later on. I also read the school record books for the Seminoles, and from your sophomore through senior seasons, you led the team in points and rebounds. My favorite stat was probably that you had 65 double-doubles out of 78 games with the varsity team. Not surprisingly, you're the career leader in that category, and your name is littered throughout the record books of Florida State.
If you get enough minutes to play, you ought to get a double-double. I mean, it's not there long.
I really like your approach to it.
You think about all you got to do is score one basket a quarter in the pros, and you get one or two rebounds every quarter, and you got a double-double at the minimum. It's not that hard, really.
For someone of your skill, perhaps, but my skill level in social competitions, maybe not so much.
Well, if you're a guard, then you should get double-doubles in points and assists. If I'm a big guy, I should be getting double-doubles in rebounds and points. You get to handle the ball a little bit more than that.
I'm only 6'1". I'm not overly tall in that respect. Please correct me if I'm wrong here, but your sophomore season in 1968 was the team's first appearance in the NCAA tournament. You went 19-8 before losing in the first round to East Tennessee State, I think by about 10 points. What do you remember of that only trip due to circumstances we'll talk about in a moment to the big dance at the NCAA tournament?
I forget exactly where we played, but we ran into a guy named Harley Swift from that school, and he was a very good player, and had a great game, and they beat us. We didn't play well. I didn't play very well, but that's just one of those things. You're young, and you learn as you move along. Bad thing about it was we never got a chance to go back to the tournament after that.
Unfortunately, there were some sanctions or probation placed on the school. Nothing to do with you personally, of course, but I think it was more to do with some things that happened with possible recruits.
It was a travesty that the NCAA would prevent kids like myself and my teammates from just competing. That's all we wanted to do was play. We wanted to play against the best all the time. But we weren't interested at all in the best traded things. We were just kids wanting to play. And they took that away from us. I'll never forgive them for doing that. They should never do that because we didn't do anything wrong. Why should we get punished for something that our coach does or administrator does or whatever on some minor infractions? But if you look at it from a political standpoint, the NCAA wanted to sometimes make an example out of, say, oh, they're tough and you better hold the line, because we were an independent school. So we had no Big Ten commissioner or any kind of ACC or whatever, Big 12, to represent us and to fight for us. We were just all by ourselves. And so we were easy to get picked on. And I went to do some research and get comparison. And I thought at that time, it seemed like the NCAA were putting independent schools or small schools on probation more than the big schools like Kentucky and Florida and Michigan or Ohio State. And I'm telling you, those were the schools that were breaking all the rules. And I know that for a fact because I played with guys that went to those schools and they told me all the stuff that they got for free and I didn't get anything. So they got to play. They got the bennies. We didn't get any bennies and we didn't get to play. The whole thing of just not playing and still sticks in my craw, as you can tell.
Well, yeah, it's totally understandable too. And I've had previous guests on the show who have talked about dodgy dealings that could have gone on behind the scenes.
To give your listeners, the young people, a little perspective, we did not have special meals. We did not have a special place to stay. We traveled by bus to a lot of games. We dressed in the locker room was the same as all the other kids did for their PE courses in the gym. We didn't have special lockers. We didn't have anything fancy at all. We ate with everybody. We lived with other students. So we were as much a student athlete as you could be as an athlete there on scholarship. Today, it's so totally different because they get so many things to help them prepare. Tutors, we didn't have tutors. We didn't have any of that stuff. So then you look at that and you say, okay, you're living that life. You're doing what you're supposed to do, going to practice, going to classes, blah, 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 doing what you got to do. And then you get penalized. What's the deal here?
Yeah, it seems terribly unfair. What do you make actually of the recent rulings that the NCAA have put in place where players can now earn money off their name or likeness?
The whole idea of amateurism. When you look up amateurism, it says people do it, play as a pastime. I don't think anybody in college on a scholarship was doing it as a pastime. This is a financial deal. You have to look at what is the value of a college education today. So if you go, hey, you know, what is it? $35,000-$40,000 a year. Okay. You're getting that, right? You're not paying that. That's what you're getting. You get books, you get room, you get food, you get to travel, you're doing a lot of different things. And then you can always spend so much time in the gym. The coaches can only have you. So if you go look at it, you're going like, it's like a part-time job. I'm making $35, $40 an hour over the course of the season. You say, one other kid at school working at McDonald's to pay their way through school or cleaning rooms in a hotel or doing whatever they're doing is making $35, $40 an hour. You got to put it in perspective. You know what I'm saying? What the really big thing I think is that they try to compare what the coaches' salaries are to what the players are doing. Now, if the coach's salary is like $100,000, $200,000 a year, they wouldn't have this big brouhaha about. But because they're making millions, then all of a sudden they go, well, the coach is making millions. How come the players are making $35 an hour? You know what I'm saying? That's where it is.
I actually hadn't thought about it from that perspective. You raise some really good points there.
If I'm a student in school right now, and I look at these athletes that are walking around campus, and I see them, they got nice things, they got cars, they got whatever. And I'm just saying, is there anything wrong with that? But it's different than what a normal student might have. And then the student learns that over and above their scholarship, they're going to get paid X more money. You say, well, what about me? I'm a student here too. Where's the fairness of just, why do I want to go even watch these people play? Because it's almost too much. It's over the top. That's going to happen a little bit, especially if you don't win. If you have a bad season, and everybody's going to say, hey, look at that. You know what I mean? These guys are not concentrating it out there. They got big heads. They get too much too fast. All those arguments will come out from society.
Just in terms of your collegiate career, I read numerous articles that talked about different jobs that you had during the summer or throughout your college tenure where you were doing all kinds of manual labor and all sorts of different things.
That's what I do best, manual labor. I'm just a toiler, man. I like hard work. I had jobs working for $1.25 an hour at Manpower, taking carts out of a shopping center, washing windows in a place, or picking rocks out of a hill, making $8 a day, which was something to do. And then I had jobs working in a silk screening place where you got Boston behind you, you'd have a jacket, you take it in, boom, they put the stuff on it and send it out. You got to unload trucks and put things in a different cubby holes for the people that had the skill jobs, which was running the printing machine. So I had jobs like that. The best job I had was as an iron worker. That was a good job. That paid me over $5 an hour, which was a lot better than $1 or $2 or $3. You know what I mean?
Are you working on large buildings or what's that involve?
You're just putting up the structure of the building, just the steel. You're just putting the steel up. So you're doing things on the ground, get ready. You got the big lifts and you got the cables and you're taking the iron and going once floor at a time. And you're involved with doing that and climbing up and then things around and somebody comes along and connects something to something and then somebody else comes along and puts some decking on and they weld it down. Then you go up to the next level. Or you put some metal stairs in a stairway in a building. Or you work in a place making soap and doing work at, like where Procter & Gamble when they had a job like that. Or you go and you're moving a safe out of one place to another place. So it's always this kind of nice teamwork deal. And I really enjoyed it. That was the best job I ever had.
That would have suited you perfectly, I guess, heading into your professional career and being such an integral part of a team in Boston. It must have also helped your physical conditioning too, I'd imagine.
Well, it did. But when I was still living at home at the time, 3 days a week, I would go to a place to work out after work, lift weights and do my drills and stuff like that. And then go home, have a little meal, take a nap, go out, drink a bunch of beer, get up early in the morning, do the work, and do it all over again.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You got to do it when you're young, because right now I couldn't do that.
Either could I. I'm 46, and I'm well beyond that myself. Good memories for sure. Now, just in terms of the Seminoles probation, in your junior season, you went 18-8. As a senior, you were 23-3, so really emphasizes how sort of unfair, I guess it was, given how great a season you had to finish your career in college, that you didn't have the opportunity to take part in the postseason.
If we had gotten a little bit lucky and had a chance, we probably could have won a national championship because we beat Jacksonville. They beat us by 4. We beat them by 6. They lost only one other game, and that was the UCLA in the finals. So we were getting up to beat them with our skill board. We were good enough to beat probably anybody if we were on their game.
Artis Gilmore's an incredible player, obviously a Hall of Famer.
He's a big man.
My wife and I were very fortunate enough to meet him briefly last year. We were in Chicago for the All-Star Weekend 2020, and at the Legends Brunch, just as we were leaving, we saw Artis a few meters ahead of us. We had some photos with him, and he's a very big man, 7'2".
He makes me feel small.
And you're 6'9".
I'm 6'9". Yeah.
Incredible, incredible. When you would also meet in the pros, you've got Artis Gilmores, you've got your Wilt Chamberlains, you've got all these guys who are considerably taller than you, yet you're playing the center position and you're trying to hold your own and did so more often than not. What sort of tactics or skills did you try and employ to battle these guys who are so much taller than you in many instances, Dave?
Sometimes when there's a clear differentiation between size and skill sets and all that stuff, I might have a harder time dealing with theirs, but they have a harder time dealing with mine because my skill set and everything is different than theirs. The worst thing is to play against guys that are kind of the same as you. That's the hardest one because there's no groove to fit into or no advantage for you to a certain degree. So I didn't really ever think that I was an underdog playing against any of these big guys. But it all goes back to be fundamentally sound enough that the coach would never want to take you out of the game or have a reason to take you out of the game. So if I was that fundamentally sound, then I could be able to deal with whatever they were going to bring. Now, granted, they handed it to me quite a bit. All right. It wasn't like every game that I was up to their equal, but there were some games they weren't up to mine either. So it's just the way it is in the game of basketball. But the whole thing is the thrill of competition. It's not going out saying, oh, this is what I'm going to do or have a plan to say, this is what I got to do against a certain person. You just kind of know what their skill set is and what their favorite things to do are, what yours are, where your strengths are. And you try to work that both times to your advantage. And if you're able to be strong enough to deal with that to a certain degree, that you got the speed and quickness and a skill set where you can make a basket, how to rebound and block out, how to play the team game and defense and positioning and all that, then it's a crapshoot. You never know what's going to happen. I have to tell you, I didn't really go out thinking before a game, oh, we got to win. I never thought about winning. I just thought about doing my best job as a player, doing my job. And then things take care of themselves.
Some fascinating insights. I really appreciate you sharing them with us, Dave. How advantageous do you think it was that you were a left-hander?
Again, it works both ways. If I go up to block a shot and the guy's right-handed, okay, I'm on that right side. But same way, if I'm doing it, and he's right-handed blocking, but you know what I mean? He's got the same advantage on me from a defensive standpoint. Bob Lanier was left-handed. Willis Reed was left-handed. Bob Rule was left-handed. Bill Russell was left-handed. There were quite a few players that were left-handed in the league as well, but I don't know that it made that big of a difference. To me, it's like you have to be able to contest a shot with both hands, depending on what the angle is. Again, that goes into the preparation and trying to do the right thing, the best thing from a percentage standpoint as you go through the ball game.
Just to put a bow on your college career, you left with averages of 19 points and 17.2 rebounds a game, and you currently rank 11th all-time in points scored, and you're still number one overall in total rebounds, not surprisingly. So a fantastic collegiate career. The NBA coverage at the time, we're talking about 1970 here, was quite minimal. How familiar were you with the league as a whole just in the lead-up to the 1970 NBA draft?
I recall I only missed one game in college in four seasons. I had a pneumonia over a Christmas holiday one time. We usually had to stay down in Florida State over the holidays because we had a few games. So we go over and stay at a hotel someplace. And I got ill, so I missed one game because of a mild case of pneumonia. I'm proud of that I played all the games and pretty much practiced all the practices. As far as the NBA, I knew very little about the NBA. The second NBA game that I ever saw, I was in it.
I wasn't expecting that answer.
I mean, I saw some on TV, but live, I was the live one. So I had never really seen Wilt Chamberlain play or Jabbar very much or Russell or any of those guys. Willis, for all the guys I had to deal with. I had never seen them play. And they had never seen me play, so maybe it was a little bit fair.
So what was the one game that you did see?
Well, I saw a Cincinnati Royals game when I was in grade school. We got to play before the Royals game and then at halftime. So that was a big thrill. I don't remember really that game because I was just like 12 years old. But then when I was at college, we had a game with Georgia Tech, and the Atlanta Hawks played at the same gym, and they were playing the Bucks with Jabbar Alcindor at the time. So as a team, we watched that game. And that was really the only game that I ever saw prior to going into the NBA.
Fascinating to hear. The 1970 NBA draft was held in March, and it was conducted through telephone, apparently, from what I've read, through the NBA New York office. Where were you on draft day, and how did you hear that the Celtics had actually selected you as a player?
I kind of knew what was going on because the ABA was around then, and they'd had a draft as well, the other league. I had signed a contract with the NBA, which probably you shouldn't do, but that's what they were doing. And most of the agents, all their players either went to the ABA or they went to the NBA. So it was like one of those agent league deals, and then they went after players. That's kind of how that worked out at the time. I didn't know that I was going to get drafted by the Celtics. I knew that Cincinnati, because from that area, Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati, I knew that they were going to draft me if I was in that pick. And for the same reason that I wanted to go away from home to go to Florida State, I didn't want to play for the Royals in Cincinnati. I wanted to be somewhere else. And I wrote Bob Cousy a letter prior to the draft, imploring him not to draft me.
And how was that received by Bob?
That's probably the only letter he ever got from a player saying, don't draft me. Especially if you got the fifth pick in the first round, which they had.
The Celtics picked you at number four, and I did notice that Cincinnati were number five.
They had number five, and so they took Sam Lacy. And then in the second round, they took Tidy Archibald.
I think he was there, second pick overall in the second round, I think he was. Yeah, true.
Calvin Murphy was right there, so. But Cousy was going to take me anyway. He didn't care what I wrote or whether to him or not.
Well, that's very, very interesting to hear. Your 1970 draft just had some incredible players throughout. There's guys like, well, Tony Archibald, I've already mentioned. Dan Issel would eventually come across to the NBA from the ABA. You've got other guys, Sam Lacy, you mentioned, Bob Lanier, Pistol Pete, Calvin Murphy, Charlie Scott, Randy Smith, Rudy Tomjanovich, and the guy that you would be co-rookie of the year with, Jeff Petrie of the Trailblazers. Incredible array of talent from that 1970 draft class.
I think to this day, we have the most in the Hall of Fame from that particular class at this point in time. I think there's eight of us that are in the Hall of Fame.
Just remarkable. Now, in the days that followed the NBA draft, there was an incredible photo of you that appeared in the Boston Globe. I emailed it to you. I don't know if you even had a chance to look at it, but you're holding like a magnifying glass and you're studying what appears to be the contract you signed with the Celtics. Do you remember the photo that I'm referring to, and what is the context behind that?
It was just a photo deal. You know, somebody wanted to say that'd be cute to look at the fine print and the contract. But it was interesting. It is telling because at that time, they weren't standardized NBA contracts. So you could negotiate every paragraph, every word in a contract. If I remember we had whole paragraphs stricken out. We wanted to say, hey, listen, if I get hurt, I want to have the ability to get a second opinion. I just don't want to have the team doctor tell me whether I can play or not, or whether I'm hurt, because he's working for the team. I'd like to have somebody working for Dave Campbell's, because we're a union and your management, it's a little different. That's just one example. The other one was kind of how you got paid, insurance and different things like that. But some of it was what you could participate in the off season. So they said you can't take any unnecessary risk to your health. So you weren't allowed to play hardball baseball. You weren't allowed to play tackle football. You weren't allowed to drive motorcycle. You weren't allowed to take flying lessons. You weren't allowed to do a lot of different things. So you could negotiate those in and out, depending on whether this is something you really wanted to do. Now, NBA contract, that's it. There is no negotiating. It is what it is. The union agreed to it, and that's all there is to it. You can add some things to it, I believe, but for the most part, there's no editing out the contract any longer.
Fascinating machinations about what could or couldn't be in those contracts.
I had no idea what the hell I was doing. You know, it's one of the first contracts I've ever seen. Back then, lawyers could not advertise. Now they advertise, doctors advertise. But back then, doctors and lawyers could not advertise. It was against the law. The guy that came down and visited me ran a laundromat in New York City. And so he was the guy that came down to talk to me about signing up with this guy who was the lawyer that he worked for. You see what I'm saying? That kind of a deal. And so he was there with me. And like I said, the contract had already been basically done with the league. But then you could add some things and work on that going forward with the team itself.
The NBA draft was held in March, but the regular season didn't actually commence until mid-October of 1970. And this is where I came across some fantastic information about you. I was fascinated to read that you played for the South Boston team in the open division of what was called the Boston Neighborhood Basketball League, the BNBL. There was a late July article in the Boston Globe, and it said that you were averaging about 24 points per game and that you were a mainstay of the club with, quote, your passing and rebounding abilities. Apparently, guys like Red Auerbach, Tommy Heinsohn, and Bob Cousy would occasionally drop in and watch as spectators. What was that experience like playing in that league as a lead into your rookie season in the NBA?
Just playing in another pickup game like I've been doing my whole life. It didn't matter that I signed with the team. And that same summer, I went down and played in the Rucker League in New York and Harlem. I had done some barnstorming, I forget, probably early March with Tiny Archibald. His agent organized a bunch of games in upstate New York and I'm going to say Pennsylvania, maybe, the way we play. Say the best high school players in a particular school district or whatever. Myself and Ollie Taylor and from Houston and Tiny Archibald and a few other guys went around, played four or five games. Then I also played in the Murray Stokes game in the Catskills. Like I say, I just want to play basketball. I'm a basketball guy. I'd love to play. The better the competition, the happier I was.
Was that link with Tiny what led to you primarily getting an opportunity to play at the Rucker tournament?
Tiny was down from New York. He was from that area, the Bronx, and he was a legend down there as a player. He grew up really fast. He didn't have much on the home life. He used to take care of kids best he could when he was a kid. He just grew up fast. I really enjoyed playing with him. And then he and some of the guys on that Texas Western team were up there as well, and they were on the team that beat Kentucky. They were from New York, too. So Tiny had a team. Floyd Lane was the coach. He was a famous guy from CCNY, I believe it was. He was a nice fella. So I would drive down on Saturday or Sunday, whatever the game was, drive down from Boston in the morning, hang around, wait till the game started, play the game, get my car and drive back home.
Your love of basketball was so strong.
It was like the Rucker League, you know, all our bikes that was so great. It was all right. I think most of the guys were not in really good shape. They weren't like I was, somebody that played all the time and lifted weights and worked out. I was at the peak of condition by that time. 21 years old. I'm rocking and rolling, man. You know, can you keep up with me? You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to set the pace. And those guys weren't used to that. And Tiny said, Barry, he says, I'm going to tell you something. The guys down there, they had never seen anybody like you. He said, you're a white guy. You come in there. And you're like kicking ass all over the place. They ain't never seen anybody like that before.
You've just got me smiling from ear to ear here with these stories, Dave. Thanks so much for sharing them. You mentioned that Maurice Stokes Memorial game. In August of 1970, Red Auerbach was asked to describe his thoughts on you at that time. And he said, and I quote, "Tremendous. Baby, am I looking forward to the season?" And then he also mentioned your terrific performance in that game at the Catskills. you were named the MVP with 32 points, 22 rebounds, and 6 blocks. You were also teammates with the number one overall pick, Pete Maravich, and you were playing for the Red Owlbacks against a team called the Dolph Shazers. Lots of things to digest there, but just to quickly give our listeners some context, the game was filled with future Hall of Famers like Willis Reed, Connie Hawkins, Dave Bing, Billy Cunningham, Wes Unseld, JoJo White, and Walt Frazier. And I believe that Wilt Chamberlain was meant to be playing, but he arrived too late after the game had finished. So all that said, how did it feel to perform so well against that incredible array of talent?
As I said, I didn't know who any of those people were. It was just a lot of guys, and I was in shape. These guys were older players in the summertime. They're not in shape. They're going up there to help with the kids and Maurice Stokes and the foundation, and they're doing it from a charitable standpoint. They're not doing it because they want to go up there and rock and roll. That's what I did. I went up there. I'm like all over the place. It really wasn't fair in a way. But again, I just had a lot of fun doing it. Being able to play with Pete, he and I became good friends, and it was nice that he was on the team. I'm setting picks for him, and I'm running the floor, and he's kicking it ahead, and I'm throwing it up and ducking it and running around. We had a good time. Played that one game outside. It was outdoors. Had good weather, and next day you head out, you go home.
Just remarkable. I'd give anything to be able to see footage of some of that game. Just in terms of your NBA debut, it was in October of 1970, October the 13th to be precise, and it was the season opening game at Madison Square Garden against the New York Knicks, who were the defending champions. They held on to win 114 to 107. In that game, you're first with the Celtics. You had 16 points and 17 rebounds. Do you remember that first game at New York?
The only thing I remember is that I did start at center. I started at power forward, so I ended up covering Dave DeBuscher as opposed to Willis Reed. And then we played one more game where I played power forward. And then after that, they started me at center, and then I played center the rest of my career.
Boston, prior to you joining the team, almost had like a center by committee for the season beforehand. I think there was two or three guys.
Yeah.
Hank Finkel was one of them. And then they rotated around until you were selected to primarily, I guess, fill that role as center.
Hank stayed on the team. Rich Johnson left. And Jeb Barnes, the original Bad News Barnes, before Marvin, he was on the team. But then they traded him. So basically, it was just Hank Finkel left from that particular rotating three-headed center that they had in between Russell's last season and my first.
You were named the co-rookie of the year in 1971, as I mentioned a bit earlier, with the Trailblazers' Jeff Petrie. Have you had the opportunity in the decade since to talk with Jeff about that great honor that you both shared?
I would tell him, I say, listen, Pete, when the players voted, I was the rookie of the year all by myself. When the media got involved, they got you involved. I go, so that's the way it is.
And how did he react to that?
He just laughed. He knew what was going on, but Portland was an expansion team. Again, that first year, you're rookie of the year, you're having a good season, you're winning more than you're losing, and then you don't get to play in the All-Star game. Now, why is that? Well, because they made a rule that they wanted to include somebody from each of the expansion teams. So it had nothing to do with performance. It had to do with they wanted to have somebody represented from those three teams. So then that takes spots away. You see what I'm saying? So it's like the first 2 years that I was with the team, we qualified. We had better records in the Eastern Conference than teams that went to the playoffs. And we weren't allowed to play because they had this thing where we were in the Atlantic Division. So New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Buffalo, I think, was the only 16 teams. So four divisions, 16 teams. Then the Central Division, there was Atlanta, Baltimore, and a couple other teams, okay? But we had a better record than Atlanta and Baltimore. But they had to have two teams from that particular division. So we were the third place in Atlantic, but we had a better record than anybody else in the conference, but we weren't allowed to go to the playoff. To me, you take the true competition and what's your record that you should be able to go, which is the way it is now. But back then, they were doing it because They were trying to build a league, build attendance, and build fans throughout the whole country as opposed to just in the eastern part or the western part.
And I'm sure that would have stuck in your craw as well, no doubt.
Well, so I'm looking at it, I'm thinking many years ago, I didn't think about it back then, but later on I'm going, the man keeps me from playing junior year in college, end of tournament, my senior year in college, my rookie year in the pros, then my second year in the pro. It had nothing to do with what I did or the our records or anything else. It was because of these rules that were made up that really weren't fair to the players. That was 3-4 years that you get penalized because that's how you're making your name. You get the respect and you're going to play and you learn. Those things are taken away from you. But again, I wasn't in Vietnam.
True. It's, as I said, it's all about that word perspective, I guess. At the 1973 All-Star Game in Chicago, you were named the most valuable player. You had 15 points and 13 rebounds in 30 minutes of play, and you defeated the West 104-84. Now, your coach, Tom Heinsohn, led the East squad that day, and I read that your parents, Jack and Ruth, were at that game in Chicago. So how fondly do you look back on that time, winning the MVP and having your parents there in attendance?
They didn't really get to see me play too often because our games were not on TV. Fact is, in order for my dad to hear any of the games, he had to drive and get up on top of a hill in Kentucky to try to get into WBZ and listen to Johnny Most and the game be in and out, in and out. So they very rarely got a chance to see me play ever in college or in the pros until they started putting some games on TV. But pretty much my career was over by the time they started putting all the games on TV. So it was nice, especially for my mom to be able to come and, you know, stay in a hotel and have dinner because I don't know that she ever traveled west of the Mississippi in her whole life. You know, we didn't travel much. But I think it was a big thrill for her and it was nice that she was able to see me play.
Now, if my research is accurate, I came across a stat somewhere that said that your father, Jack, was a member of Bellevue High's state tournament team back in 1938. Is that correct?
Probably. He was born in 20, so he would have been 17, 18 years old at that time. They were a senior. I didn't know that what you tell me that they went to a state tournament. I didn't know that they did that, but he was about 6'5". He grew up pretty quick, and so when he graduated, he was one of the bigger guys, but he wasn't too big to go into the service because he had difficulty being in the Army and fighting in World War II.
I read that upon his return, he went from a World War II veteran to a barber.
He did. He said he started cutting hair in the service for a couple of bucks here and there, just, you know, the other infantrymen and stuff. That's where he kind of got the bug. He was also worked in a public finance company. And actually, the interesting thing is that after high school, he didn't go to college. He got some job. But one of his jobs was as a professional dancer. So he would do ballroom dancing in front of people, teaching them the steps like Arthur Murray kind of a thing over in Cincinnati. So when he enlisted in the Army, they asked him what his background was. So they made him a radio man because they thought he was in entertainment. This is crazy the way, but that's what he did in the service. He was the guy that they would put him up on top of a hill and he'd give him the quadrants and tell the ships out in the harbor where to put the bombs. Of course, the enemy was trying to take him out. So he ended up almost getting killed, got a Purple Heart. He got malaria when he was over there, went to the hospital, and then got better and put him back on the front lines. Big 2-year camping trip.
The incredible sacrifices that people have made for their country, it's remarkable. I'm glad to hear that he made it back safe and sound.
He made it back. Otherwise, those 6 kids won't be around.
That's it. We wouldn't be talking today, that's for sure. Just incredible information, and I really appreciate you sharing the details here. In terms of that 1973 season, your Celtics had the best regular season record ever to this date, 68-14, and you took the eventual NBA champions, the New York Knicks, to a 7th and deciding game of the Eastern Conference Finals. You were named the NBA's most valuable player in 1973. based on what I've read, is it fair to say that there's a big contrast between how you found out that you won the award versus the players of today?
One of the pictures you sent me was me holding a basketball with tape on it saying MVP. And so before a game, they came in and told me that I didn't want this MVP that was voted on by the players and coaches. You couldn't vote anybody on your own team. You couldn't vote for yourself. So everybody had to vote for other people. And so I ended up winning that vote over in Jabbar, which kind of doesn't make any sense, but it happened because we had such a good record. That was the whole thing. Okay, what are we going to do? Well, we got a basketball. Let's put some tape that we tape ankles with and put MVP on. And that was the picture. That was the whole celebration until the next season, and then they had the trophy and all.
Unbelievable.
It's just so different now. I mean, everything's so hyped now. It's crazy. You know,
it is a bit over the top. You mentioned Kareem Abdul-Jabbar there. In 1974, you won your first NBA title. The Celtics defeated the Buffalo Braves and the Knicks on their way to the NBA Finals, where you met Kareem and his Milwaukee Bucks. It went to a seventh and deciding game that you won at Milwaukee. But one of those defining moments of your career happened in Game 6, where at Boston, you were showing that tremendous hustle that we've been talking about, where you did that sliding move across the famed parquet floor at Boston Garden, chasing for that loose ball. Do you mind just indulging me just for a moment there to talk about that play, your hustle, and just playing against Kareem, obviously one of the greatest players of all time, if not the best of all time, and winning that first championship, Dave?
I did not have a really good game, that sixth game. It was a double overtime game. Actually, I switched down and was guarded Oscar Robertson at the time. And so I was guarding him, and I got the ball, and I flicked it away from him. And it was a game where if I could have kept my feet and got that ball and went down and laid it up, we'd probably win that ball game. That's how close it was at the time. I flicked the ball out, and I went to go, and for some reason, whether it was fatigue or whatever it was, I couldn't really get my feet underneath me. So I see this ball just going out there. I'm going, okay, here we go. Oh, we need this dive bar. I'm trying to keep it from going out of bounds, get the possession and go down and try to win the ball game. I wish I would have kept my feet, because then I could have been a real hero.
How was it to play in front of the Boston fans? I know that each team sort of has their own fan base and they love playing in front of their home fans, but it just seemed to be a whole different atmosphere at the Boston Garden. Did you sometimes get too over the top and hyped before games, or did you have to try and level yourself out a bit? What was that experience like, and then just winning the title in general in that 1974 season?
Well, what I found is that as a professional, you play a lot of ball games, play over 100 a year if you're in the playoff. And so getting all hyped up and wasting a lot of energy before the game made no sense. Long before Phil Jackson and all this other stuff, I used to meditate and really almost lay down in a closet on a cot and just relax in the dark before the game. I never went out and shot around a game and stuff. And so just trying to relax so that I knew I had a reservoir of energy at the end of the game, because I'm playing 40 minutes a game. That's what I average for the most part, but for those first 6 years in the league. You play 100 games a year, you're not going to get hyped up for everything. You know, but half the time, you're feeling kind of crappy. You're tired, might be a little hungover. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's like, let's just go out and do the job, try to get a W, you know, roll.
I love it.
So the fans were good, to answer your question. The fans were good. And I think from when I got there, their average attendance was about 7,000, even through all Russell's great years, the Celtics winning. During the season, they only averaged about 7,000-8,000 people a year. By my sixth year, we were up to about 13,000. So the crowd liked the way that we played, and we were pretty successful. And then when Larry Bird came, it went from like 13,000 to 15,000, which was a maximum.
Some incredible times throughout the 70s and then into the 1980 season when Bird joined. About 3 weeks before the 1975 NBA season commenced, your Celtics played the ABA's Denver Nuggets in one of those interleague games. at Asheville in North Carolina. What are your recollections of those NBA versus ABA games before the leagues ended up merging?
The game you're talking about that we had in North Carolina, there was a referee, Earl Strong. He was an ABA guy. A lot of guys were ABA, and then they went to the NBA when they merged. So Earl was a guy. He had the left, and he was a real character. You wanted him. If you were on the road, you wanted Earl Strong to be one of the referees because he didn't care about the crowd. He loved to stick it to the crowd. Actually, he's one of those kind of guys. Something happened. I was ticked off, and the ball was on the court, right? I see Earl going over to pick the ball up, and just before he picks it up, I kick it. And you would have been proud as a soccer guy. That ball went like this, just went winding up in the stand, threw me out. And so it was an exhibition game. It was like the best kick I ever did for a basketball.
Oh, my goodness. And how did Earl react? Was he quite taken aback?
He just, out of here. So I went, got me a beer, a hot dog, and sat up in the top of the stands and watched the ball game.
That's fantastic. So moving on to 1976, another terrific season in Celtics history. You went 54-28, and you ultimately met the Phoenix Suns in the NBA Finals. You won in six games, and it was your second NBA title. Along the way, though, you took part in that iconic Game 5 at Boston Garden. I recently had a mate of mine, another Adam, on the show, and also Bob Ryan, your good friend, who came on to talk about that Game 5 in Boston. How would you describe that series against the Suns, but particularly that incredible three overtime classic versus Phoenix?
Well, Phoenix upset Golden State with Rick Barry and Clifford and all the different guys that were on that team. I was happy because we did not do very well against Golden State that year. Beating Phoenix in the finals as opposed to Golden State was benefit for us, I think, on our team that helped us be able to get another championship. Pretty much our teams were kind of the same size-wise and depth-wise. I think we were a better team. We were a little more experienced because we had Havlicek and Don Nelson and Silas, and those guys were senior of most of the players that were on Phoenix team. I mean, Alvin Adams was a rookie. He was a rookie of the year, but he was a rookie. Westfall was, he came out in 72, I think. He was only 4 years in the league, and he had played with us when we beat the Milwaukee team. And so that's how we got Charlie Scott because of that trade. It was a good, pretty evenly matched. We beat them pretty handily in Boston. And then the whole media got into, Boston's being really aggressive. They're beating up on those Phoenix Suns and blah, blah, blah. But we go out to Phoenix and play a game. They're calling fouls all over the damn place. It was like foul shot after foul shot. We end up losing a close game. I think if they would have just repped it the way they had been repping, we'd probably beat them. All this stuff wouldn't happen. But we'd been, and they went two games out there. So now we go back to Boston for that one, and then you got the triple overtime deal happen. That was the only game I ever played, and it started one day and ended the next. It was a late game. It was like, I think it started about 9 o'clock on a Friday night, and I think we were still playing past midnight.
I think it ended at about 10 past 12 or something, like in the morning. Yeah, you're right.
The only game I would play went into two different days.
Just before Havlicek hit that fantastic running bank shot, you'd fouled out. So what was it like from your vantage point to be sitting on the bench, not being able to be in the game as much as you obviously would have loved to have been on the floor for those multiple overtimes?
It's frustrating because you're in the mix of it all the time, and then all of a sudden you're not, and there's nothing you can do about it. You don't want to get mad that I thought it was not a very good call. They called a charge on me, and I thought the guy then Sautre came and went under me a little bit, but be that what it is, the referee called a charge, and I went out. And so you sit there, and you just hope for the best because there's nothing else you can do. You don't coach, rah-rah, get all excited about it. He's kind of just there and watch it like a fan would. Glenn McDonald came through for us. He really made a big difference in that game. Think about this. He was a guy that played a few minutes in the first quarter. He sits out all the second quarter, all of halftime, all the third quarter, all the fourth quarter, the first overtime, the second overtime, and he puts him in the third overtime, and he makes three baskets and helps us win the ball game. That's pretty cool.
Very cool.
But to be ready and to be able to produce in that kind of a pressure-packed situation. I see him all the time. I go, you're my hero, my man. I got a ring because of you.
That's fantastic. To come through in the third overtime of an NBA Finals game, which you went up 3-2 with the victory, to then wrap it up at Phoenix for game 6. Yeah, tremendous stuff. So, yeah, Glenn McDonald, very important figure in that game.
Very, very important. And usually in the playoffs, what happens is your bench plays a huge role most of the time. Because guys get hurt or they foul out, and everybody knows what everybody's doing. And so really, your bench guys make a big, big difference in the playoffs.
You mentioned John Havlicek a moment ago, and so did I, in terms of his running bank shot. How important to the Celtics' lore was Havlicek? He passed away not too long ago. His impact on the NBA, but also just the Boston Celtics in general. Can you put it into words, the impact that he had on the franchise and on yourself?
Well, I mean, he was just a great athlete and a very unselfish player, even though he's the all-time leading scorer for the Celtics. He played 16 seasons. He played the first few as a substitute coming off the bench in that six-man role like Frank Ramsey did. But when he was with us, he was our captain. He was our guy. So he was our go-to guy when like Bird was, or like LeBron is, or like Dwayne Wade and somebody like this, all these guys, you get your go-to guy at the end of games when you need a W and you need good execution. But John was going to get the ball because we knew he was going to make a good decision. He was a clutch player. That he was our leader. Like today, guys said, well, I'm a leader, and I got to be a leader, and a loud leader. You go, my good. I never heard him ever say he was a leader. All he did was lead. He didn't brag about it or say what he was going to do or how he was going to be a leader. He just was that guy. He did it the way he played and the way he thought, the way he carried himself, and the fact that he had been instrumental in a lot of the championships with the Celtics prior to me getting there. This kind of knew the new group in the 70s. So he was our guy, and a great guy, really a great human being, good man all the way around.
Pleased to hear that. I did read in my research for our chat today that you went to Japan in 1977 for some sort of promotional tour for Tiger shoes. Does that ring a bell?
I worked with Tiger for a while. It was interesting. I went over there 3 years in a row to do clinics and look at factories and talk to people and that. It was a pretty good deal. I was able to get a lot of shoes for kids to wear at my basketball camp in Massachusetts. The coaches used to buy shoes for their teams. I sold them the shoes for $1 a piece so they could go back and put shoes on all their players on their teams.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, we had a good time.
In 1978, your Celtics missed the postseason for the first time since your rookie season. Tom Satch Sanders took over as coach from Tommy Heinsohn during the season, and then after a 2-12 start to the 1979 campaign, Sanders was replaced by a guy named Dave Cowens, who went 27-41 to close that season. What was it like to have the opportunity presented to you to take over as coach, but still being a player at that time in that 1979 season, which was quite unique?
It makes no sense to do both jobs, and nobody's done it since, I don't think. Why would you have somebody do both jobs? Dave DeBuscher did it earlier in the night. There were a few guys that did it. Obviously, Bill Russell did it. It just doesn't make any sense. Casey Jones and Bob McKenna were my assistant coaches at the time. John Whitebrow was the owner of the team, and I had just renegotiated a contract. So in his mind, he wanted me... He wanted to really get his money's worth. So he had me a player and coach. While I was coaching, I didn't get any more money. I just was getting the same money as I got as a player, but having all these damn headaches of organizing and dealing with different guys. We had so many. I think we had 20 guys on the roster that particular year. We had one guy, Don Smith, who played at Iowa. He changed his name to Abdul Aziz. I saw him one time and go, you are big time Abdul, because they have a ship named after you over in Saudi Arabia. But anyway, we acquired Don Smith, Abdulaziz, on the road. Then we cut him while we were on the road. So he's the only guy I know that only wore a green uniform. He never got to wear a home uniform for the Boston Celtics. That's how the turnstile was. People were just coming in and out. It was insane. Actually, we won our first six games. We were losing, and we ended up winning six games. And then Phyllis George, who was Miss America, was married to John Lloyd Brown. She was in love with Bob McAdoo. So John Lloyd made a deal with New York to bring McAdoo, the boss. And Red didn't want to do it. And McAdoo didn't want to be there because he and I were arch rivals. We were playing against each other when he was in Buffalo for many years at the playoffs and all. And he was one of the best players I ever played against. But it just didn't fit with me being a coach and a player and him being on the team. You know, we're playing the same position. So when we got here, I benched myself to play, you know, to start Bob McAdoo on our team.
Wow. I was about to say, how did you go in terms of coexisting with him, given your history?
It's just part of the lore.
Before the 1980 season, Bill Fitch was then named coach of the Celtics. And then, obviously, a rookie, Larry Bird, comes onto the scene. Now, the team had one of the biggest single-season turnarounds in NBA history, 61 and 21. Do you ever think about the what-ifs if you had to continue on as the head coach and play it again, or were you happy to see Bill Fitch take over and then you just became a player again?
I had never thought about coaching, so I did it basically for the team. I took one for the team the year before. But if I'd have been smart, I'd already told you I was in college. I wasn't the greatest student, but I was applying myself. Did all right. But if I'd have been smart, I could have been the coach of the year. All I had to do was say, coach, Bird comes on, we're going to win a lot of games. I'm coach of the year, man.
That's fantastic. So what was it like to see a young Larry Bird emerge onto the national scene, have such an immediate impact in Boston and being teammates with him as you are sort of getting towards the closing season or two of your career, Dave?
You could tell right away. I mean, this guy, he loved basketball and he worked at it. He just had a knack. He was just into it all the time. What I mean, he wasn't an every now and again kind of guy. Every minute he played, he was kind of into it, competing, and I love that about him. He was even more into it than I was, actually. And he had these great hands, just the ability to catch and pass like instantly. And he had a great vision, better vision than I had offensively. Defensively, I was a little bit better than that, rebounding, staying in front of people and all that stuff. And I'll play in the center position. He was playing kind of with three and a four position. But offensively, this guy has some remarkable skills and instincts. So smart, thinking, just seeing things going on. And he just applied himself and got better and better and better.
You've been very generous with your time. I won't hold you for too much longer, but thank you so much for chatting with me today. Your close friends, as we mentioned, with the legendary sports writer Bob Ryan, and your relationship goes back many decades. In his excellent book, Scribe, which I've got right here in front of me at the moment.
It's a good book.
It is a great book. He opens the book with a story about you visiting his hotel room in early October of 1980 and the fallout that that would have in terms of affecting the Boston Celtics franchise, given that you were looking to possibly retire. Do you mind just relaying that story about what happened with those, I think he described it as a sheaf of papers, and you knocking at his door on the hotel room?
He's obviously a really good writer, and I had written my own basketball obituary in a way, you know, it's going away from the game. We're going to retire. So I thought, instead of somebody else writing it, I'll give my own 2 cents worth. And so after I was finished writing it on the yellow line paper, I went over and knocked on Bob's and said, hey, can you look at this and make it sound somewhat professionally written? That's some act job. And he said, fine. He started reading it. He goes, he says, he was actually talking to Paul Silas on the phone when they got into the room. I talked to Paul a little bit. He was out in, I don't know if he was in Denver, maybe Seattle at the time. And then I called Red Auerbach and told him what was going on. And that was it. And then he took the story and submitted it to the paper. I think he made a few edits, a few changes in it, but he said not much. He didn't do much to it.
An incredible story, and he opens the book with that. He was quite stunned, I guess, as he was reading initially to then realize, oh, hang on, this is actually a retirement statement of sorts. So,
but he responded like a pro. He did his job.
On September the 9th of 1982, Boston did a deal with Milwaukee. You'd play your final NBA season with the Bucks, and Quinn Buckner became a member of the Celtics. I recently learned whilst doing a bit of research for the chat today that you were very close to becoming a Phoenix Suns player before the deal fell through. How did that move to Wisconsin come to be?
Well, I basically heard about it. I was ready to go to Phoenix. I think they had a deal for a draft pick that had held on to my rights, even though I had retired a couple of years prior. But again, one of those red R-backs, shrewd moves, and he held on to it. Right at the end, I guess Don Nelson and them talked. They decided that they would go for Quinn Buckner. And so Red called me up and said, you're not going to Phoenix, you're going to Milwaukee. So that's kind of what happened. I could change the play, reservation, I'm going to Milwaukee. And that's how I got out there with Nelly. Quinn was happy. He got to play with Birdie, and that was a good thing. But that particular season, that postseason that I was at Milwaukee, the Bucks played the Celtics at the Conference Semifinals, swept the Celtics, 4-0. They hit McHale, they hit Bird, they hit Parrish, they hit Maxwell, they hit Nate. I don't know who they had at the backcourt, but they had their big deal. But you never hear the Celtics talk about that particular playoff series. You never hear them talk about that. You know, Milwaukee, we had a good team. And we had Bob Lanier and Harvey Catchings, Alt Lister, Marcus Johnson, Brian Waiters, Junior Bridgman. We had a good team. We had a chance to beat Philadelphia if they'd go on and play. I think it was the Lakers. That was the year Philly, I think, won the championship and beat the Lakers.
You're right. I think they swept the Lakers 4-0 in 1983.
I didn't get to play in any of those games. I had torn a quadricep tendon earlier in the season. It got worse and worse. I tried to play, and Nelly said, no, I just can't rely on you to be able to do everything you got to do out there. So I didn't even get to play in the playoffs. So that's why Nelly brought me in there, you know, to give him another body, an experienced player in the playoffs.
How did it feel just to be watching from the bench, knowing this is the team that you won two titles with and had such a celebrated career with? What was it like just to contrast that with now being a member of the Bucks?
I may be the only guy to come back and play for another team under their number being retired. So when I came back and played for Milwaukee, my number is hanging up in the rafters. I may be the only guy to ever do that.
That's a good point. Yeah, true. On May the 13th of 1991, you were inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame, and a fellow Hall of Famer, the great Bob Pettit, presented you ahead of your acceptance speech. He talked briefly about how he admired your intensity and desire. During your speech, you mentioned how you were known as the guy who's often falling down. Do you remember what happened just a few seconds after you talked about that?
Yeah, the Hall of Fame emblem fell off of the front of the podium that I was standing at. I mean, how does that happen? It just doesn't make any sense. Actually, Beth Hamilcheck afterwards said, did you have a little butt that you pushed to make that thing fall off? And I said, no, it just happened.
I rewatched the acceptance speech a few weeks ago. How did it feel like to be up on that stage talking about your entry into the Hall of Fame, looking back on all that you achieved as a player?
You try to sum it up and kind of give people a feel for what you went through. And I mean, now you hear these speeches and they just thank everybody in the world. There was a lady named White. I want to say Nora White, a really great country basketball player. And she got inducted into the Hall of Fame the year afterwards. All right. Bob Lanier was up there and he talked. You're supposed to have like 5 minutes to give you a thing. If you're a coach, they never adhere to 5 minutes because they want to talk all the time. So Bob Lanier was up there and he was talking about this, that, and the other and getting all misty-eyed and talking about how many people are so good. When she got up to the podium, she said, "I want to dedicate this award to my mother and father. Thank you." And walked off the stage. She got a standing ovation.
That's certainly succinct.
It was great. That's all she said. That was her whole speech.
Didn't have to plan that one too much.
I know.
Oh, man, that's fantastic. Basketball Digest had a regular feature, which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. Now, you played in some incredible games over the course of your career, both in college, even some exhibition ones, and obviously in the NBA. Is there one game from your career that stands out more than any other?
Not really. Probably the fact that I had a good game against Kareem in 74 on the road to close it out with a championship. And that was the first time I could go like this, put my finger up and say, we're number one. You know, in my whole career, high school, grade school, college, or whatever, to do it against that guy on the road in a seventh game, that's probably the most memorable for me.
Tremendous highlights throughout your career there. Was there any particular significance to the jersey number that you wore throughout your career? I think you had number 13 in high school and at Florida State, but then changed to number 18 with the Celtics and then number 36 in Milwaukee.
The 18 came when I went to Boston. I wanted to wear number 13. And Red said, you can't have number 13 because Will Chamberlain wears number 13. And he was the arch rival of Bill Russell. So he said, nobody's going to wear number 13 on the Celtics. So I said, well, just close them in there. Am I getting eight? Closing the threes, am I getting eight? And that's how I got that. Bob Briano and Jim Luskatov and Bailey Howe all wore number 18 prior to me being there.
That's a great story. And number 36 in Milwaukee?
I just doubled 18, that's all. Stay with the routine. And just to let you know about, there's 18 letters in my name. There's 18 letters in both of my daughters' names. My both daughters were born on the 18th of their month in July and May. So
how good is that? I love that.
18, it seems to be a number for us.
What point did you start to realize that the daughters' names were 18 and you were 18?
I don't know. I started looking at it, but it just started happening. We didn't do it on purpose.
I like to examine the numbers sometimes and to see if there's any sort of links or significance.
It's all about the numbers, man.
Yeah, it is.
All about the numbers.
Real thrilled to have you on the show today, Dave, and I want to thank again your good friend, Bob Ryan, for helping us connect.
It's nice to talk to you. You're the only guy I know that you have two first names and two last names.
Actually, I've got two middle names, James and Vincent, so I've actually got four first names. Adam James Vincent Ryan. So there you go.
There you do it, man. And possibly four last names, too. Although Vincent, I don't know, maybe.
Sam Vincent.
But I know there's James and the other names you have, Ryan, Adams. It could be anywhere.
I've got them all. I'd love to, at a future date, invite you back and talk about your post-playing career. There's so much to talk about, even just in terms of your coaching alone. So if you're up for that at some stage in the future, I'd love to welcome you back. But thanks again for talking with me today. It's really appreciated.
All right, Dave. Good to talk to you. You did a great job.
Oh, much appreciated. Thank you. And have a great night. What's left of it?
You have a good day. What do you say? G'day?
Yeah, g'day. G'day, mate. That's what I say. It's a bit stereotypical, but I say mate every second word over here in Australia. It's g'day, mate. Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. Tap the microphone icon on my website to send me a voicemail. You can suggest discussion topics or guests you'd like to hear conversations with. Time now to share another great review from a fan of the show. Thanks to DeJour18 via Apple Podcast Australia. It's titled Brooklyn Nets Oz Fan and is rated 5 stars. It reads, "This is a great podcast. As a fairly fresh NBA fan, I really appreciate the time, knowledge, expertise, and care shown by Adam to cultivate this podcast. As a new fan, I also look forward to interacting with you on Twitter and Instagram as the season begins. Thanks again, mate." And his handle on Twitter is at
Brooklyn Nets Oz, and that's A-U-S. Thank you very much, mate. Much appreciated. Worldwide, the show has 184 ratings on Apple Podcasts with an average of 4.9 stars. I've been underselling it this whole time. I thought it was 4.5 stars, and I learned today it's actually 4.9, so even better. There's 98 reviews across all providers, so we're closing in on that magical 100 figure. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways to support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Word-of-mouth recommendations are truly worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my free NBA history newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming episodes, future guests to appear on the show, and more. Sign up via my website or simply email me, inallairness@gmail.com. You can follow my show in various ways. Search In All Airness, three words, on your listening app of choice. The show is available on most platforms. Check the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with a great range of guests. My Instagram and Twitter handle is @InAllAirness. Search In All Airness on YouTube and Facebook too. Join me next time for another edition of the show.